I want to finish up our talk on honor, shame, and extend it in the pervasiveness, not just in the New Testament and Roman society as a whole. Honor, shame, we talked about the way in which you define honor. Honor equals the way in which you perceive yourself as an individual and the way in which the community either affirms or denies that. And that equals your honor, right? Remember the equation that we wrote out? That you did a test on, you get an honor through ascribed honor, what you're born with, or acquired honor, how you fight for it, the challenge response game that we described. Let me give you seven characteristics then of an honor person and a person in an honor shame society. Seven characteristics that an honorable person will have connected to them in an honor shame society. Number one, an honor person in an honor shame, or a person, I keep saying an honor person, a person in an honor shame society, they will see themselves, himself or herself, through the eyes of others. That is how they will define themselves, through the eyes of others. And that makes sense. If the community is ultimately what defines the honor of someone, they're going to be constantly establishing who they are based on what other people say they are. And it is true that within that context, if you are disconnected from the community, then in essence, it means that you cease to exist. Which makes Matthew 18 all the more harsh. You see what I mean? In an honor-shame society, if someone is sinning, you go to them one-on-one. If they continue to sin, you bring more people. If they continue to sin, you bring them for the whole community. And if they continue to sin after that, you put them outside of the community, treat them as a tax collector or a pagan. In essence, what you're saying is you cease to exist. That's huge. Yeah?
So, I know this is a Matthew question, but with that context of it being heavily in the honor shame, is that, obviously it can work today, but does it have the same effect today?
Yeah, I think it does. Absolutely. All you need to do is think about how it feels whenever you're really going after to get into a college or on a sports team or something like that and getting rejected. You're put outside of their community. You're not even allowed in. That does something to you. That'll mess you up psychologically. Or, you know, like with cliques. You know, there's a certain clique that you want to be a part of. And maybe you were a part of it for a while, then they got to really know who you were and they kicked you out. Yeah, there's shame there and you feel it. It's not that we're totally shameless in this society. It's just that we just don't honor much, and therefore a lot of the effect is shame. A lot of times the way people react to it now is they're like, fine, you know, screw you, and they'll give like the finger to the group. And that's how they respond. Honor shame society, they're devastated, they're destroyed. You might even go and hang yourself like Judas did. Let that sink in for a minute. Yeah?
I think I've heard of situations where people have tried filing lawsuits against churches for disfellowshipping them.
Yeah, absolutely. I was at a church that they did church discipline someone, and they did threaten to get lawyers involved, and they got a lawyer, and a lawsuit began, and then it was dropped because the church basically backed out. Whatever. Bottom line is this is kind of funny the way it worked, too. Let someone do a lawsuit and say, fine, you're allowed in. But just so you know, you got back in the community because you sued. And the person's there, but they're awkward the whole time, and they eventually leave. Because ultimately what they're refusing to do is admit they were wrong. And the community is saying, hey, you could be here. All we're saying is you've got to follow the rules of the community. And so the person sues their way back in. How many of you would feel a part of that group if you sued your way back in? And so let them. Let them. Number two, individuality is to be concealed and never revealed. Individuality is to be concealed and never revealed. If progress is a threat to the group, and it is, and we'll talk about that more in a bit, then isolating yourself or sticking out as an individual is actually a threat to your own honor. Number three, stereotypes are not unwanted or unwarranted or looked down upon, but they're a way of life. In an honor-shame society, they believe that if you know one in the group, you know them all. Which is one of the reasons why Nathaniel and John can say, can anything good come out of Nazareth? You know one, you know them all. Period.
Can you repeat that?
Stereotypes are not unwanted, unwarranted, looked down upon, but they're a way of life. They're a way of life. You know one, you know them all. In an honor-shame society. which makes protecting the Christian honor all that much more important. Number four, morality is never an individual issue, but it is always a communal issue. This is one of the things you'll hear a lot of times is people will say, oh, the Sermon on the Mount is about individual ethics, but not communal, not national ethics. That is ridiculous. I think there's exegetical reasons for saying that's ludicrous. I even know people that teach on campus that dichotomy. From a sociological perspective, that is asinine. I mean, just flat out honest. In an honor-shame society, individual ethics versus communal ethics, they would see no distinction at all. For what an individual does impacts the entire community. Therefore, how can you say this is for the community but not for the individual or vice versa? That's just ludicrous. No, Sermon on the Mount defines the nation of Christianity. We are a separate nation, you know, 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. For you are a royal priesthood, a holy nation. We are a separate nation. We have our own politics. As a matter of fact, Philippians chapter 1 says, conduct yourselves in a worthy manner. The word for conduct yourselves in a worthy manner of the gospel, worthy manner, is the word that we get politics from. He says, conduct yourself. Live by your politics as a polis, as a separate city, a separate nation. So, Sermon on the Mount, individual versus national ethics, bogus. Especially from an honor shame perspective. Number five, the individual is expendable if it serves the entire group. That's why you can have Caiaphas saying, it's better for one man to die than for an entire nation to be in trouble. The individual, if the sacrifice of the one individual preserves the community or furthers community, get rid of them. It's not that big of a deal. And this is the concept behind suicide bombers today, by the way. If this one person can be killed in order to bring dignity, or in order to further the war of the whole community, go strap a bomb to yourself. Honor shame society makes perfect sense. In our society, doesn't make any sense at all. Kamikazes in the in World War II with Japanese. It was World War II, right?
Yeah.
Whatever. I'm a Roman historian, so. Just kidding. Not really. Kind of. Number six, progress is seen as a threat. This is one we've already touched on a bit, but this is a separate thing. You've gotta have intention. This is how the thought process goes. There are limited goods in society. Therefore, accumulating goods means someone else is losing goods. As a result, progress threatens the entire group. Therefore, if you wanted to progress in any way, shape, or form with wealth or anything, honor, anything, you would have to do it painfully slow. Painfully slow. So as not to let people notice that you're actually grabbing some of the limited commodities for yourself. Progress is a threat to other people's honor, and therefore a threat to your own group. Therefore, if someone's singling themselves out, they will be rebuked back down to size by their own group. Jesus' family coming to take him captive because he's out of his mind. Why? Because he's claiming to be something bigger than what he really is. The city of Nazareth, a little bit upset with the way Jesus is talking in their synagogues. Why? He is claiming more than what he should from a small town of Nazareth. Number seven, predictability is a virtue in an honor-shame society. Predictability is a virtue. Bruce Molina says this, the honorable man in the first century male ideal is one who knows how to live out and live up to his inherited obligations. He neither encroaches on others nor allows himself to be exploited or challenged by others. He works to feed and clothe his family. He fulfills his community and ceremonial obligations. He minds his own business in such a way as to be sure no one else infringes on him while looking for personal advantages for himself. Predictability. You're very predictable. You walk the line, and if you see an opportunity, you'll seize it. And the way you seize it is seizing it without really acting like that you're seizing it. That's honor-shame society. Very passive-aggressive. And some of the ways they act. Implications. Societal implications. There are really two things I just want to focus on here. Number one, you will see honor-shame really impacting gender issues and generational issues. Women and children were looked at in the exact same way. Parasites on society. parasites on society. They contributed nothing to the group as a whole, both honor-wise or material-wise, resource-wise. They were an absolute liability. And they were treated that way. As a matter of fact, this is the public transcript of women by Livy. Livy in History of Rome, 34.1.12, he describes the appropriate roles of women. But listen to the public transcript that he perpetuates. Never, while their men survive, is feminine subjection shaken off, and they themselves abhor the freedom which the loss of husbands and fathers produces. You hear that? Women abhor the freedom. Why? Because that freedom is a threat on the community and themselves. Freedom and individuality. This is one of the things I don't think that we're understanding with the honor-shame cultures that we're moving into with our wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and we're trying to fight for women's roles. I'm not saying it's not necessary. What I'm saying is you got to understand what you're walking into. And when the women aren't as open to it as you think they should be, there's reasons for that. It's not because they're keeping the public transcript. It's because their entire society is structured around something that says, if you engage in this, if you stand out as an individual, if you, woman, fight for your own voice, you're threatening your entire society group, your family, everything. Does that make sense? I'm not saying that liberation for women is bad. What I'm saying is we got to understand who we're talking to. It's not like we're offering them a gift that costs them nothing. That's just not true. We're offering them a gift that threatens their entire existence. Therefore, when they take it, that's astounding. And if they don't, it's not because they're dumb or brainwashed. It's because literally, their society doesn't necessarily provide them an option at all for it to have a voice as an individual. And democracy is established on the individual voice. And if you're walking into an honor shame society that looks down upon the individual voice and relishes in stereotypes and dichotomies, you have to expect that democracy is probably not going to fly that well because of what's at the heart of the system that you're offering them. Does that make sense? It's just a conflation of grammars. We're talking past each other. Don't you want freedom? Yes, but if freedom means to separate myself from my community, that's not the type of freedom I'm looking for. You see the difference? So I don't think that Livy's public transcript is exactly accurate for all women in the ancient world. I don't think that's accurate. Nevertheless, it's not totally inaccurate. Because sometimes you can find security in what your society is founded on. Does that make sense? Also, too, some of the implications. You see this in war strategies. The ancient world of Rome doesn't fight wars a lot of times the way that we do. We usually fight wars, I'm talking every country in the world, not just America, for geopolitical reasons. Where will it position yourself to either gain the most resources or even to position yourself to control some of the key traffic in the world, things of that nature. We fight for positions that will be most advantageous for our imperial agenda. Now, Rome did do that on some level. But sometimes Rome would be fighting a dozen wars, all of which they knew the places they were going to be fighting and going for were places that had no resources at all. But the reason why Rome was fighting it is because if they started a war thinking it had resources and they found out it didn't have resources, stopping that war would be shameful. So they would bankrupt themselves in a war that just to flat out win. Because they, in winning, they would gain honor. Even if it didn't give them a geopolitical advantage at all. Does that make sense? You'll see tons of wars going on in Rome. And a lot of times, you're going, why would they be going after that? And the reason comes back to honor shame, not geopolitical advantageous situations. All right. Now we're going to move to patron-client relationships. Honor shame society. Honor shame. If you don't have that foundation, you don't understand the purpose of patron-client relationships. First of all, let's define terms. The client. The client is a free man who entrusts himself to another and receives protection and provision. The client is a free man who entrusts himself to another and receives protection and provision. The patron, you guys okay with me moving on? The patron was the person to whom the client entrusted himself that had the means to both provide and protect his clients. So the client is a free man who entrusts himself to another to receive protection and provision. The patron was the person to whom the client entrusted himself that has the means to both provide and protect his clients. Now the means is what is the issue. What is the means? Sometimes it's through the use of his honor, and sometimes it's through the use of actual resources. And we'll get to that in a minute. But first, let me talk about the purpose of the relationship. The purpose of the patron-client relationship is to be able to provide for yourself or your community from the client's perspective. To provide for yourself or your community goods in a socially acceptable manner. To accumulate goods in a socially acceptable manner that would normally not be allowed or available to you in ordinary circumstances. So why would a client entrust himself to someone else? Because in an honor-shame society, if you're progressing, it's a threat to your community and everyone around you, your immediate family and the people that you belong to you. You can't just go and just say, I'll just work harder and make more money. Not in an honor-shame society. That's a threat because the limited commodities means if you're accumulating more, you're stealing from someone else. Right? Therefore, patron-client relationships exist so that someone that can't provide all the goods he needs for his family or for his close community is able to accumulate more goods in a socially acceptable manner. And the way they do this is they indebt themselves, not in debt in the sense of loans, because ultimately it's not even material goods that's necessarily the key issue here. They indebt themselves to someone that can give them, provide for them what they need that they would not have been accessible to them otherwise. The patron-client relationship then is an asymmetrical relationship. It is not between two equals. It never is. It is between two unequals from drastically different classes that enter into a relationship that engages in mutual benefits. Let me describe that. The patron would take on clients and provide for their goods in multiple ways. Number one, they would do it financially. Through heavy taxation and subjugation and different things like that, sometimes it was just hard for people to survive. So a client would take people on and they would provide for them financially the different things they would need maybe just to get to the next day, food. Other times they would provide for them financially just for things that bring their family dignity, like proper burials. Sometimes a client would seek out a patron and enter into this asymmetrical relationship so they could have a proper burial for their family. Brings dignity to their family. Dowries for their daughters. If they could not afford a dowry for their daughter, sometimes a client would seek out a patron. Or training for trades, etc. Other ways that patrons would provide for clients was not just financially, but was through honor. Sometimes you flat out just couldn't get to different jobs unless you had somebody leverage their influence for you. This happens still today, by the way. This happens still today. We have senators, though, writing letters as kind of being an honor power broker for some of their own clients to elevate them to levels that client never would have been able to get to without their help. Other different ways, there would be an indebtedness then from the clients to the patrons. And so this becomes the role of the client. So you understand the role of the patron, right? They're the ones that are using finances or honor in order to provide for or protect for their patrons. Or their clients. The client then, their job was to further the public life of the patron. To further the public life of the patron. Cicero, in Speech in Defense of Marina 70-71, he describes the role of the client like this. He says, men of the lower class have only one way of either earning or repaying favors from our class, and that is by working on our political campaigns and following us around. Furthering their public life. He goes on and says, this constant attendance, which we have come to expect for men who are honorable and generous, is an appropriate activity for friends, another word for clients, who are of a lower class and not busy. As they themselves often say, they cannot plead cases for us or pledge security or invite us to their homes. Yet they ask all these things from us, and they think that the favors which they receive from us can be repaid by their service. And he says, actually, that is our relationship. What they do, their job is to make me famous. That's their job. Perseus 1:54-55, satirizing the patron, making fun of him, says this. You know how to present a shivering client with a threadbare cloak, and then you say, I love the truth. Tell me the truth about myself. And the job of the client is to tell the patron who he is. Oh, you are so grand. You are the provider of all. You take care of, you are the king of. That's the job of the client, to further the public life of the patron in any way that he can, make him famous. And this is one of the reasons why, let me just skip really quick to this. Some of the language that's used in the New Testament describing our relationship with God comes straight out of patron-client relationships. Straight out of it. This is one of the reasons why I actually have people that get really upset with me, believe it or not. It's so weird. But I literally had like a five-page interaction with someone on just the way that I signed my emails, making him famous, Shane. The guy's like, Jesus is famous. We don't do anything to make him famous. He doesn't need our help. And I said, yeah, you're right. My patron doesn't need me to make him famous. But I am so indebted with all the different gifts that he has given me. Actually, the words that's used to describe what the patron gives to the client is the word charis. Grace or gift. Charismata, where we get the gift language. That's the language. The Greek language. The Greek words that are used from a patron to a client. It's the same word that we get grace and gifts from. So when 1 Corinthians 12 is talking about the gifts that we give, that's patron-client language. As a matter of fact, then when it talks about what we are indebted to God, what does God require of us? What is it that He requires of us? Faith. Pistis. And that's actually the language of the patron-client language. The way in which a client would respond to the patron, make him famous, do whatever he could to advance the public life of the client, that was called pistis. Faith. Where we also, the Latin word, we get the related Latin word, pietas. Piety, reverence, obedience, submission. Therefore, if you really want to understand your relationship with God, you need to understand patron-client relationships. Because He is giving us things that we by ourselves could not have achieved, like the gifts that we've been given. Grace, salvation, even prophecy or healing or teaching, etc. Without Him, we would not have had any of those. Therefore, we are indebted to Him. And therefore, my job is to use all of those gifts that He gives me, to leverage those to make Him famous, to be faithful, to show pistis. You see how this makes sense? It's in the New Testament. So if in your book you're going, how in the world in my book, I don't see any of the Roman society or stuff like that, look for these words. This is patron-client language that doesn't come out of nowhere. Some point we will smuggle in some of the rest of the stuff on honor, shame, and religion and politics, how it affects the Pax Romana, how it affects worship and war in the ancient world, and we'll smuggle that in a bit. Love you guys. Tomorrow is Romans. Tomorrow is Romans. Tomorrow is Romans. Love you. See you then.